All right, let's dive deep today into Isaiah chapters 7 and 8. We're working with excerpts from a lecture by Robert Van Ooy on the major prophets, plus some commentary from E.J. Young and Hazel Bullock to help us.
Yeah, these chapters, full of intrigue, prophecy. Get ready for some serious historical drama, by the way, with like real spiritual depth.
Definitely.
What really gets me about these chapters is like how they weave together the political tension with these really profound theological truths.
Right.
About God's sovereignty and the impact of our choices, human choices.
Okay, so let's set the scene. It's the 8th century BC,
mm-hmm.
and King Ahaz of Judah, he's facing this like terrifying alliance between the kingdoms of Israel and Syria. It's like the regional superpowers, you know, ganging up on him.
Yeah.
Would you be worried?
Oh, absolutely.
If you were Ahaz.
I'd be freaking out.
Right.
So then the prophet Isaiah shows up with a message from God.
Right.
Don't worry, Ahaz, I've got this.
Wow.
To prove it, God even offers Ahaz a sign, this miraculous event, to show that he's in control.
That's amazing. A direct message from God and a sign. What more could you ask for?
Right. Talk about reassurance. But here's where things get a little crazy.
Yeah.
Ahaz refuses the sign.
He does. Why would he do that?
Yeah, it's a real head scratcher. Gotta wonder what was going through his mind, right?
Yeah.
Fear. Pride. Maybe he just thought he could handle it himself. I don't know. Whatever the reason, though. His refusal leads us to one of the most debated verses in the Bible, Isaiah 7.14.
Oh, yeah. The famous prophecy.
Okay.
About the virgin birth.
Exactly. The verse says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel.
Hmm.
But the question that scholars have been wrestling with for centuries is, who is this child?
Right. And why is that Hebrew word for virgin such a big deal?
Well, the Hebrew word they use is Alma, often translated as virgin. But some argue it can also just mean young woman.
Oh, okay.
And that's led to different interpretations of the prophecy.
So some believe that it's talking about a child born soon after, like maybe to Isaiah's wife or even Ahaz's wife.
Yeah, more of an immediate fulfillment to reassure Ahaz in his current crisis.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. But then you have others who see it as a direct prophecy of Jesus' birth.
Okay.
Pointing to Matthew's gospel, where he quotes this verse and explicitly links it to Jesus.
Right. Okay, but wouldn't that make the prophecy, I don't know, less impactful for Ahaz in his situation? I mean, how could a child born years later be a sign for him right now?
That's a good point. And this is where the idea of dual fulfillment comes in. Some scholars believe the prophecy applies to both a near-term child and ultimately points forward to Jesus. Mm-hmm. This idea that prophecies can have like a short-term and a long-term fulfillment. That's super important for understanding many of the prophetic passages in the Bible.
Wow. Fascinating. So in a way, God is speaking to both Ahaz's immediate need and revealing this much larger plan that will unfold over time.
Exactly. It's like layers of meaning. And this is where E.J. Young's argument about the specific word Alma comes in.
Okay.
He says that Alma is the only word in Hebrew that absolutely means an unmarried woman.
Oh, wow. So if they had used any other word, it would have left room for doubt.
Yeah.
It had to be Alma to point to this miraculous birth.
Precisely. He draws a parallel to the story of Rebecca.
Oh, okay.
In Genesis 24, where we see the same three Hebrew words for young woman used in different contexts. And that helps clarify that Alma is specifically talking about a virgin.
So the choice of words in the original Hebrew really matters here.
Absolutely.
It unlocks this deeper meaning, a hint at the miraculous nature of the prophecy. But we shouldn't forget about Ahaz in all of this.
Oh, right.
What happens to him after he rejects God's sign?
Well, instead of trusting God, he makes an alliance with Assyria, which was a powerful empire at the time. He's basically trying to control his own destiny.
Okay, so he's manipulating the situation.
Yeah.
Instead of trusting God.
Yeah. And this is a crucial point. Ahaz, in his fear and pride, chooses human power over divine intervention. It really highlights a recurring theme in the Bible, the tendency to rely on our own strength instead of trusting God.
Right. Trying to build our own little kingdoms instead of surrendering to God's bigger plan. But that never really works out in the end, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And Isaiah drives this point home with some, like, striking imagery. He describes Assyria as a hired razor brought in by Ahaz to, like, shave or conquer his enemies.
That sounds kind of ominous.
It is. Isaiah then adds this, like, chilling detail. The razor ultimately turns on Judah itself.
Whoa.
Ahaz thought he was using Assyria to his advantage, but he actually invited a dangerous force that would eventually threaten his own people.
It's like hiring a hitman who then comes after you.
Exactly.
Wow, that's powerful. That's a powerful way to illustrate the potential consequences of Ahaz's decision.
And those consequences would have this ripple effect, impacting not just Ahaz, but his son, Hezekiah, a generation later. As we see in Isaiah chapters 36-39, he ends up facing the very threat his father tried to avoid. It's almost like poetic justice.
Wait, so Ahaz's attempt to control the situation actually backfires.
Yeah.
And his son pays the price.
Yes. And it gets even more symbolic than that. The Assyrian messenger who demands Hezekiah's surrender, he stands in the exact same spot where Isaiah first warned Ahaz.
Whoa. That's a chilling detail. It's like history repeating itself. A reminder of the impact our choices can have.
Exactly. And that sets the stage for the next part of the story, which takes an even more intriguing turn with the introduction of another child. And another prophecy.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. This is getting good.
But before we jump into that, what stands out to you so far?
Well, I'm struck by the contrast between God's willingness to intervene and Ahaz's refusal to trust him. Makes you think about the signs God might be offering us in our own lives.
Right.
And whether we're open to seeing them, you know.
That's a great point. It's a reminder that sometimes the most important choices we make aren't about strategy or power, but about whether we're willing to trust in something bigger than ourselves.
And it makes me wonder about the other child mentioned in Isaiah chapter 8. What's their story?
Well, that's where things get even more complex. This child carries a very different message, and their prophecy unfolds on a much faster timeline.
All right, let's dive into that.
Okay, so we've got this king, right? Made a questionable decision. Prophecy about a child born of a virgin. And at W, in Isaiah chapter 8, there's another child.
Right, yeah. This one is named Maher-Shalal-Hash-Baz. Not exactly a name you hear every day. What's the significance of that?
It's a mouthful for sure, but the name itself is like super important. For understanding this prophecy, it means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. This child is actually Isaiah's son, and he represents the short-term prophecy, foreshadowing the imminent destruction of Israel and Syria, the very nations that threaten Ahaz.
Okay, so this is not the same child as Emmanuel. Two different children. Two different prophecies.
Exactly. Two distinct prophecies unfolding on different timelines. Maher-Shalal-Hash-Baz represents like a quick, immediate fulfillment of God's word. Within a few years, both Israel and Syria, they're plundered, just like the name foretold.
Wow, that's a powerful demonstration of God's power and the accuracy of his prophecies. But why give this short-term prophecy in addition to the long-term one about Emmanuel?
It's like God is giving Ahaz and us a like mini fulfillment to validate the bigger long-term prophecy that is still to come. If God can bring about the destruction of Israel and Syria, just as he said, surely he can also bring about the miraculous birth of Emmanuel in his own time.
That makes a lot of sense. It reinforces the idea of dual fulfillment. God working on multiple levels, you know, speaking to both the immediate situation and revealing his larger plan for the future.
Yeah, it's a reminder that God's actions always have purpose, even when we don't fully grasp his plan. He's like weaving together this complex tapestry, and sometimes we only see a small section of it.
But in this case, we get to see both.
Yeah.
The short-term and the long-term prophecies. It's like getting a sneak peek behind the curtain.
And the imagery that Isaiah uses to describe these prophecies is like super captivating. He contrasts these gently flowing waters of Shiloh with the overwhelming floodwaters of Assyria.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Break that down for me. What do these waters represent?
Okay, so Shiloh, it was a gently flowing stream in Jerusalem. It symbolizes trust in God, reliance on his provision, peace, stability. Assyria, on the other hand, with their powerful army sweeping across the land, right, they're depicted as a raging flood, symbolizing the consequences of rejecting God, relying on human strength.
So it's a choice between peaceful streams or a raging torrent. I know which one I'd rather be in.
Yeah, it's a powerful visual. Speaks directly to Ahaz's dilemma. He chose the flood of Assyria, thinking he could control it. But Isaiah's warning him and us, true security lies in trusting in the Shiloh of God's provision.
But Isaiah doesn't sugarcoat things. He acknowledges that the Assyrian flood will reach up to the neck. That's pretty scary.
It is. But even in this warning, there's hope. Isaiah emphasizes that the flood will not completely overwhelm Judah, because it's ultimately Emmanuel's land. Even in the midst of judgment, God's protection remains, because of the promise represented by Emmanuel.
It's powerful. It's like saying, even when we make bad choices, and face the consequences. God's promise remains. We're not abandoned.
Exactly. It's a reminder that even when things seem bleak, even when we're surrounded by those floodwaters, God is still in control. He hasn't forgotten his promises.
Okay, so what does all this mean for us today? I mean, we're not ancient kings facing these military threats. What are the Shilohs and Assyrias in our modern lives?
That's a great question. I think the principle applies to any situation where we're tempted to rely on our own strength instead of trusting God. Could be a financial crisis,
sure,
a health scare, relationship breakdown, anything that makes you feel like you're drowning in floodwaters.
So is it about recognizing those moments when we're tempted to, like, grab the razor of human solutions?
Yeah.
Even if they could hurt us in the long run.
Exactly. We all face Shiloh and Assyria moments in our lives. The key is, like, discerning which path we're choosing, and are we putting our trust in the right place?
Okay, so how do we make that discernment? How do we know if we're trusting in Shiloh versus Assyria?
That's a question that requires some, like, careful reflection. Mm-hmm. It's about examining our motivations, our fears, our source of hope. Are we making decisions out of fear and desire for control like Ahaz? Or are we seeking God's guidance and trusting in his provision even when it's hard?
That's a powerful challenge. It makes you really think about where you're placing your trust.
And it's not always easy to choose Shiloh. Sometimes it feels, I don't know, counterintuitive, even foolish,
yeah,
to trust in God when everything around us seems out of control.
Yeah, it's hard to resist the urge to grab onto something tangible, like a razor that promises relief, even if it's not the best long-term solution.
But that's where faith comes in. It's about believing that even when we can't see it, God is working, his promises are true, and ultimately he will bring about his purposes.
Okay, I'm really starting to see how these ancient chapters can speak to our modern lives. It's about recognizing the Shilohs and the Assyrias we encounter every day and making intentional choices about where we place our trust.
Exactly. And as we move into the final section of our deep dive, we'll see how this theme of trust and God's sovereignty comes full circle. We'll explore how Hezekiah, despite his father's mistakes, chooses the Shiloh path and experiences God's deliverance in a remarkable way.
All right, let's dive into that. I'm eager to see how it all plays out. So Ahaz tried to, like, control the situation, made an alliance with Assyria, but that backfired big time. And now his son, Hezekiah, is left dealing with the fallout. What happens next? Does Hezekiah make the same mistakes as his dad?
Yeah, that's the big question. Will he repeat history or will he go a different way? Remember Isaiah prophesied that the Assyrian flood would reach, like, up to the neck, but wouldn't completely drown Judah?
Right, right. Because it's ultimately an annuals land. Mm-hmm. So that promise of God's presence and protection, it's still there, even with all the chaos and uncertainty.
Exactly. And this is where we see a glimmer of hope in all the darkness. Hezekiah, unlike his father, chooses to trust in God. When the Assyrian army is surrounding Jerusalem, he doesn't try to cut deals with other nations or rely on his own military strength.
Wow. So he chooses, like, the Shiloh over Assyria, even though things look really bad. It's pretty brave.
Yeah, it is. Hezekiah turns to God in prayer, admits he's helpless, and begs for deliverance. And God, he answers in a big way.
Okay, tell me what happens.
One night, an angel of the Lord strikes down 185,000 Assyrian soldiers, just wipes them out. The army's destroyed and the threat to Jerusalem is gone.
Whoa, that's incredible. It really shows God's power and faithfulness. Hezekiah's trust in God literally saved his kingdom.
It really does. It reminds us that even when things seem impossible, God can step in ways we can't even imagine. Hezekiah's story gives hope to anyone facing these huge, overwhelming challenges.
It makes you think about those times when, you know, we want to give up, or we're just overcome with fear and despair. Maybe we should take a lesson from Hezekiah. Turn to God in prayer and trust. He can do anything, even the impossible.
Absolutely. Isaiah chapter 7 and 8, they started with this political crisis, a king facing a terrifying choice. But through the prophecies of Emmanuel and Mahershalal Hashbaz, we see God's plan unfolding on these different levels, with warnings and promises.
We see what happens when Ahaz chooses to trust in human power, and then we see the reward for Hezekiah's faith in God. Our choices have real consequences, but God's always faithful.
And at the end of the day, it all comes back to that name, Emmanuel, God with us. That's where real security comes from, the foundation of our hope, no matter what we're up against.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one thing you hope listeners will remember?
That even when you're afraid, when you're not sure what's going to happen, God is there. He's working. And his promises are true.
That's a good word. And I hope they're inspired to look for the Shilohs in their lives. Those times when they can trust God, rely on him, and experience his peace, even when the world feels like it's spinning out of control.
It's been a great deep dive. We talked about prophecy, the impact of the choices we make, and witnessed God's power to deliver us.
And all started with that one word, Alma, hinting at the miracle that changed everything. Makes you wonder what other little details in the Bible are just waiting to be uncovered.
That's what's so amazing about Scripture. There's always something new to learn, new layers of meaning to explore.
So keep exploring. Keep digging deeper. Keep trusting in God, who is always with us. Emmanuel, thanks for being here with us for this deep dive.